I'm going to a town that has already been burned down. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm going to see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America. I'm gonna make it up for all of the Sunday times. I'm gonna make it up for all of the nursery rhymes. They never really seem to want to tell the truth. I'm so tired of you, America, making my own way home. Ain't gonna be alone. I've got a life to live, America. I've got a life to live. Tell me, do you really think you go to hell for having love? Tell me enough to forget everything that you've done is good. I really need to know, after soaking the body of Jesus Christ in blood, I'm so tired of you, America. Took advantage of a world that loved you well. I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm so tired of you, America. Making my own way home. But I won't be alone.
Be alone.
No, I've got a life to live, America. I've got a life to live. I've got a soul to fill. I've got a tear.
Do you people have any clue how amazingly fortunate I am to work with Michael? He's my producer, my board op at the network. And shortly before going on, he said, any idea what kind of music you want to run to open tonight? I said, nah, just pick anything. Why don't you pick George Michael? And he picks this song, I'm So Tired of America. I'll not bore you with the whole story about what that song is about, but it, in so many respects, fits the direction this program is going to go tonight. Although, early on, you're going to ask, what the hell was he talking about? Good evening, Jeff Bennett here for another installment of The Edge of Darkness. Glad to have you here. And, of course, then I had a Skype friend who was teasing me about last night, betting me on Skype just moments ago that I would pass out and fall asleep by 27 minutes after the hour again. So I get off the air last night. By 7:15, I said, that's it, I'm going to bed. I could not sleep. I could not sleep. I could not sleep. And 2-3 o'clock in the morning, I finally fell asleep. Had to get up early. I had things I had to get done today. Took a brief nap. I'm beat out. Good Lord. And it's getting cold. I'm sitting here in my studio And this particular room is a cold room in the house. And who in the world's calling? Oh, that stupid school. What does that mean? Did the kid miss another class today? I'm going to kick her butt. Oh, well, life goes on. You know, this program tonight took an interesting direction because of several things that came before me. One is a piece that I'd published on as a headline on Sierra Madre Precious Metals last night. And then I had another piece submitted to me for publication, which amazingly had some interesting links and tie-ins to the same thing. So we're going to get on it. And I will share with you that to some degree, part of what we're going to talk about is economically rated, related, but not completely. I was on the phone with a client out of Chicago this afternoon. We talked briefly late last night as well. In fact, he called me about 11:30 my time. He works nights in Chicago. And we start talking about the direction of economics in this nation, around the world, what's going to happen ultimately to Bitcoin, what's going to happen to the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. And you begin to realize that all the things we've talked about have happened before, so many times before. And so in discussions surrounding of the world's monetary systems today, there's usually one thing almost everyone can agree on, that money should be controlled by the organizations that we call states, or more importantly, sovereign states. And these days, when we say the U.S. dollar, we mean the currency issued by the government, which really isn't issued by the government, it's issued by the Federal Reserve, but whatever. When we say the British pound, we mean the money issued by the regime of the United Kingdom. So this assumed need to have state-issued money has not always been the reality, of course. Indeed, the history of the rise of the state is a history replete with efforts by states to replace private sector money with state-controlled money. And the reasons for all of this are quite numerous. Control of the money supply, usually complemented by intervention in the financial sector, allows states much more flexibility in expanding state spending and state borrowing. But perhaps most importantly, this allowed states to spend prodigiously in times of war and other emergencies. And as we will see, the struggle between the state and private finance has been a long one, my friends. It took many centuries for regimes to secure the sort of legitimacy and regulatory power necessary to claim a monopoly over money. And yet even today, states are still somewhat constrained by the realities of international competition between currencies. They are also constrained by the continued existence of quasi-monies that function as stores of value, such as gold or silver, cryptocurrencies, maybe. And yet it's impossible to deny that the state has made enormous gains in recent centuries when it comes to taking control of money. The order of these events also reminds us of another important aspect of states and money. The rise of states, my friends, was not conditional on kings or princes seizing control of the production and regulation of money. Rather, the causation runs in the other direction as states became more powerful, and they used that power to also take control of the money. Now, in the ancient world, the despotic empires of old, under which we could include the Roman Empire, were careful to mint their own money and to control whatever primitive financial systems existed. And the Romans famously devalued their currency for long periods of time, most notably the Diocletian, under Diocletian, a leader, which ultimately led to the ruin of many Roman citizens. And we talked briefly about this subject a couple of weeks ago. Now, according to David Glasner, the prerogative of the sovereign over the coinage was preserved after the fall of Rome. But this was only in theory. The civil governments of that period were far too weak to enforce a monopoly on money. Martin van Creveld writes that given the decentralized nature of the political system and its instability, European rulers during the Middle Ages were generally in no position to imitate their Oriental counterparts in the Persian Mongol and the Chinese empires. Oh, so see, the little chinky-dinks were involved with it even back then. But moreover, there wasn't that much money to go around in Western Europe. Coins were often in short supply, and the agrarian nature of Western Europe meant much trade was done through bartering, all of which began to change in the later Middle Ages as Europe urbanized, began to produce an increasing agricultural surplus, driven largely by Italian bankers who set up branch offices in France and Spain and the Low Countries. A financial system began to take shape, which included the production of both coins and banknotes. And yet the monetary system was dominated by the private sector. And we're reminded that a sizable amount of money in that period was produced not only by the slowly emerging state, but by private institutions. Before 1700, attempts to develop credit systems succeeded only in these places where private banking and commerce were so strong as to virtually exclude royal authority. In other words, where merchants were the government. So common wisdom held that whereas merchants could be trusted with money, kings could not. Concentrating both economic and coercive power in their own hands, all too often they used it either to debase the coinage or to seize their subjects' treasure. I could do some interesting comparisons with Joey, couldn't we? Merchants could be trusted with money, but kings or presidents could not. Oh, well. So the kings of Europe sought to control the money nonetheless. One of the earliest meaningful attempts materialized where else but England, where monarchs early on developed a more centralized and cohesive national regime. So thus, after the early date of 1222 in England, money changing and trade in bullion was a strictly enforced royal monopoly exercised by the royal exchanger. Enforcement consisted of government officials engaged in acts designed to suppress private trade in precious metals, to purchase or confiscate foreign coins, to deliver them to the Tower of London Mint for recoinage. Well, it's relatively unclear how well it was all enforced, but such concerted efforts and a national regulation were far more haphazard in much of Europe. For example, the French state, the largest and most centralized state on the continent, they sought in earnest to take control of the money supply by the 16th century. And the results were mixed. Efforts to hammer together a national monetary regime began in the late Middle Ages, and yet France was not unified monetarily. Silver circulated in the West after the middle of the 16th century, gold coins before, and copper in the East, infiltrating from Germany. So, in practice, national kings needed to buy off uncooperative nobles with monopoly privileges, the rights to tax, the sale of titles. Kings relied on manpower supplied by nobles to carry out royal prerogatives. And as late as the 16th century, Although in principle, only the king had the right to coin precious metals, in practice, he farmed out this privilege, as was also the case in the exploitation of the royal domain and tax collection, because kings, apart from Prussia, had only limited bureaucratic staff. Achieving a central monopoly of the coinage took 2 centuries. And moreover, national borders were somewhat porous. Foreign coins circulated freely. And yet a French edict of 1557 counted 190 coins of different sovereigns, different nations in use in France at that time. So the lack of national monetary monopolies in most cases did not stop nascent European states from engaging in 2 centuries of state building. By the 16th century, France was already building an absolute state even in the midst of ongoing currency competition. By the mid-17th century, of course, the state had come into its own with absolutism gaining ground in France and Spain, Sweden, other parts of the continent. And in England, although the Stuarts failed to achieve their much-desired absolute monarchy, the state progressed far in the direction of a centralized, consolidated state during that period. And so indeed, by the mid-17th century, Europe's 30-year wars, what might be called Western Europe's first era of total war, ended with the consolidation of the state system throughout Western Europe. But indeed, war, state buildings, two things that were often one and the same, drove efforts to build government revenues through debasements of the coinage. It was war with Scotland that drove Henry VIII to begin a multi-year period of debasing the currency in 1542, which continued long into the reign of Edward VI. War drove other monarchs to similar ends. And on the continent, Charles V devalued the gold dollar in 1551. In the 17th century, European monarchs engaged in what they called progressive debasement. That was all in anticipation of the 30-year war. And yet many princes in the 16th and 17th centuries did a roaring business in currency depreciation. I know that sometime in the last probably 6-7 months or whatever, because that's the subject I continue to return to. I am a history lover. Still a student at this age. And the stories we've told about Rome and how their currency destroyed people, destroyed its value, the debasement, the reduction in the amount of silver or gold or copper that was in a specific coin, ultimately destroyed that nation. But Spain and France, other rising states of the period, accomplished all that we've just spoken about without establishing true monopolies over the money supply. And yet currency competition limited what states could get away with. Even back in those days, if national states had been able to solidify de jure monopoly control of money within their own borders, the sovereign's money still faced competition from currency in neighboring states and principalities. And just as dozens of different types of coins circulated within France, it was always possible for merchants and financiers and more mobile classes of individuals to move their wealth in such a way as to avoid using the more heavily devalued currencies. And thus, the monarchs were cognizant of the risk that devaluation brought. Too much debasement of the currency could cause merchants, even residents, to flee to competing imported or black market currencies. Practical limitations controlled how much a regime could debase its currency. Thus, when Henry VIII began his campaign of debasement, he combined it with a broader wartime policy of confiscating goods and church property and compelling loans. So in the 17th century, The ability to escape debased national currencies was further facilitated by the advent of the Bank of Amsterdam. Established by the city of Amsterdam in 1609, the bank technically was a government bank, and they calculated the values of the no fewer than 341 silver and 505 golden coins circulating in the Dutch Republic. And the bank helped merchants identify which coins were good and which were debased. And the bank then provided credit based on coins' real value, regardless of the coins' claimed nominal values. The bank issued coins known as bank guilders, which became, interestingly enough, the world's most used currency at the time, or perhaps even a reverse currency, reserve currency, of a similar status to the U.S. dollar today. And this was not due to any moral righteousness on the part of the Dutch politicians. It's likely the Dutch regime would have also preferred to manipulate its own currency for gain, but the smallness of the Dutch Republic and its reliance on foreign trade greatly limited the regime in that regard. And thus, the Dutch were essentially forced to become a reliable, competitive financial center in order to compete with the larger states. And so, we begin to assert control over the banks. Control of the coinage was the only one aspect of states' fights to control money, because much of the money being handled by Europe's banks during that period was in the form of what they call bills of exchange, which facilitated the movement of funds across Europe without the need for physically moving metallic money. And so these bills began to function as money as well, and even as states were asserting greater control over coinage in the 15th and 16th centuries, private institutions were thus beginning to develop paper money. And according to one Kindleberger, it began early in the 13th century. The functions of the bill of exchange expanded in the 16th century as it became successfully assignable, transferable, negotiable, and from the 1540s, discountable, bridging time and space, serving as private money as distinct from specie, which was the money of the prince. Specie. Oh, that's right. Gold and silver. So banks, however, proved to be essential. They provided access to money in many cases, since even as late as the 18th century in many places, coinage was in short supply. And those shortages may have been especially acute where wage work had replaced subsistence farming, agricultural barter, and the new breed of employers needed money of various types. Bank-created paper money thus served an important role in providing a medium of exchange when coins were either unreliable or unavailable. Think about this. About a year or so ago, you'd go to your bank, and they all had change. They all had signs. And they weren't the only ones. Stores had signs. You know, please use your debit or credit card because we've got a shortage of coinage. I understand exactly why there was a shortage of coinage. Because the government finally got off their butt and decided to recall every bit of coinage they possibly could because they were looking for 40 and 90% silver coinage. And so when you go to get change today, you're getting almost in all cases brand newly minted coins. I'm getting very few silver coins today. I still get some 40%ers. I've not seen a 90% coin in quite a while. But all that was transpiring at this time began to diminish the dependence on the sovereign's coinage. Princes came to view these banks as troublesome competitors. The banks, unlike ordinary consumers, had the knowledge and the means to more carefully evaluate regime money and to accept devalued coins only at a discount. But unhappy about the fact that banks could often do an end run around the king's coinage, states then sought to compel payments in metals, which the sovereign could more easily control. and the tension between the state monopoly over coinage and private banking was manifested in legislation that was frequently enacted to restrict the creation of notes and deposit by banks. In the 15th century, for example, hostile legislation in the Low Countries caused virtually all banking activity to cease. So, dealing with all of this, the downside of crippling a polity's banking sector is sizable. So eventually the state abandoned the strategy and learned to love paper money. But getting the public to accept government-issued paper money would be a very long uphill battle. Van Creveld places the first government attempt at paper money in the 1630s when the Spanish Duke of Olivares, in need for funds yet again for the 30-year wars, confiscated silver, provided interest-bearing letters of credit in their stead. Given the reputation of princes for debasing the currency by this time, this paper money swiftly depreciated. And but a few years later, Sweden attempted a similar scheme, but it also quickly failed. Interesting to bring this up. We talked about in the war effort, confiscating silver, providing interest-bearing letters of credit, etc., because there was this shortage. And I have to think about several years during World War II when our five-cent coins, the so-called nickel, was called in. And because there was a massive shortage of nickel that was needed for the war effort, and it was replaced with 35% silver. Very few people knew that, or even know it today. Some years ago, I went to the bank, and I got some change, and something I did, I don't know what the heck it was. And I got these few coins in my pocket, and something wasn't right. I knew it. And I looked at this coin, and my eyes popped out of the sockets. Because I got a World War II nickel. 35% silver contact. I still have that coin. So by now, it was not until 1694, Bank of England, after more than 300 years of modern state building, that the foundations were laid for a true note-issuing central bank. And even then, the Bank of England did not begin as an institution that created money and did not have a monopoly on issuing banknotes until 1844. What, 150 years later, something like that? Oh, longer than that. So rather, the Bank of England initially financed the government deficit by issuing shares. Shares which, not surprisingly, were very popular given the fact that the bank also enjoyed a monopoly on government deposits. A national bank in France, the Banque Royale, followed in 1718. But like the Bank of England, the Banque Royale did not possess a functioning monopoly on issuing banknotes. It did not stop the French bank from printing a great many notes. And yet it did so, sparking a financial crisis in the wake of the Mississippi bubble. So it was not until the 19th century that Europe's states established and wielded the sorts of central banks and money-issuing powers that we now associate with state monopoly powers over monetary systems. By 1870 or so, not only had central banks monopolized the issue of notes in most countries, but they were also beginning to regulate other banks. And the rise of the central banks throughout much of Europe provided states with unprecedented powers in terms of issuing new debt and financing explosive government spending in times of emergency. And the regulatory role of central banks further solidified the regime's control of their financial systems overall. And yet, ironically, it was also in the 19th century that states faced mounting opposition to state monopoly powers in the form of the classical gold standard. All of this was a result of the rise of laissez-faire liberalism in the 19th century, which was especially notable in Britain and France and the U.S. Increasingly in Western Europe, the liberals and the commercial class insisted on an obligation to maintain the convertibility of gold or silver at a fixed parity. And these formal definitions of a currency's value in metals were important in that they made it easier to see the extent and effects of government manipulation of the currency, which was all to the good. But it offered no challenge to the state's growing monopoly over money. After all, the gold standard could be, and repeatedly was, suspended for reasons of war. In other words, it would be a mistake to regard the era of the classical gold standard as a period of state weakness in financial and monetary matters. On the contrary, the classical gold standard was built on a firm foundation of state power limited only by legislation. And the legitimacy of the state's prerogative to ultimately oversee the monetary system was not in question. By the end of the 19th century in Britain and in many other key polities, the days of privately issued banknotes and privately minted coins were over. Now, the U.S. lagged this trend somewhat, but the outcome was eventually the same. In other words, there were no institutions left that could realistically challenge the state in terms of issuing and creating money. 19th century did present obstacles to the state's ability to inflate and debase, but states nonetheless remained very much the victors over private money, private banks, private mints. I guess it should not surprise us that the classical gold standard was followed by the gold exchange standard, a system thoroughly dominated by state actors. The total abandonment of precious metals soon followed. In many ways, these changes to state-dominated monetary systems was a reversion to the traditional way of doing things before the collapse of the Roman Empire. The era following the end of Roman despotism lacked states able to establish monopolies on coinage and money production. And yet, as civil governments grew into increasingly powerful states, they also asserted themselves as masters of money and finance. Few now question this state of affairs. That's our economic history lesson for this week. And I'm sure that a good amount of this is over some people's heads. Boring as hell, live in hell, get out. But it shouldn't be. You think that our currency is not being manipulated today? That's why our dollar has lost 96% of its purchasing power in the last 110 years or so. Because of this very same manipulation. It's an absolute joke. It's not backed by gold. It's not backed by silver. It's not backed by anything of value. Oh, what? You know, the faith and the trust, blah, 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 blah. I think I'd just soon have some more gold. Silver to an extent, but mostly gold. Think about it. Several interesting conversations today about that very issue. My client in Chicago is getting very nerve-wracked over what's going on, as am I, as am so many people. I had something interesting happen today as this restoration project comes to an end. We got the second shelf in the laundry room yesterday, which allowed me to bring out some more supplies, toilet paper, paper towels, get them back up on the shelves. And my wife had picked up a package of toilet paper at Costco the other day. Now, something I've noticed about Costco's brand of toilet paper, which I think is it's a great buy, and I think it's a better quality than getting Charmin. Charmin's much thicker, and it's so soft on the buttocks, et cetera, et cetera. But it also has a tendency to clog the flush down very easily. And typically when I buy a package of the Costco toilet paper, you get, I think, 5 or 6 packs in it. Each one's got 6 rolls in the package. I opened up this package, and by the way, over the last number of months, they have downsized the size of their rolls of toilet paper. They've gone from 450 sheets down to 300 and some. I open up this package today, and not only is it 450 sheets, there's no English writing on the roll of toilet paper. It's all in Hispanic. It's Mexican. So apparently we've got a whole bunch of toilet paper sitting offshore in Long Beach that they can't deliver to us because truck shortages, fuel shortages, all this other nonsense. But they're also not packed in 6 packs. Each one are individually wrapped rolls. I was absolutely shocked at that. I've never seen that. Interesting. Well, there's some things for us to keep in mind. Rome, my friends, was not destroyed in a day. It was all done for 30 pieces of silver. Think about that. Since the end of the War of Northern Aggression, Americans have been conflicted. When this nation armed itself to proclaim that might makes right, even at home, we entered a perpetual battle for our nation. Keep in mind, the actors changed, but not the stakes. The Civil War fractured this country irreparably. And just as then, the ultimate goal is control. The demo socks are about to have it all. In that war, the opposing sides used crude weapons by today's standards. I like to say, thank God we've evolved. Now we use technology to lay waste to our country and each other. Any tool is only as good or moral as the person using it. Keep these things in mind. And our friends, the demo socks, are masters of most high-tech media forms and formats, especially those who control them. Technology is a massive, massively powerful tool, will be the ruination of America. Of course, actually, we could say the same for both major parties. They're like 16-year-olds with a bottle of bourbon and the keys to a Corvette. You know, it's taken years of finagling, cheating, hallway dealing, backroom shenanigans, corruption, quid pro quo, but the demo socks now have what they've been lusted for all along. They are our government, and they are power drunk. There are, of course, checks and balances built into the system. But who could foresee the moral capitulation, the collapse of so many elected representatives? How can 535 people that claim to love this country hate us, we the people, so damn much? It's simple. They took 30 pieces of silver when they sold us out. This past year or so has got to be the most devastating 12-month, 15-month period in our history. I cannot believe that one group could wreak this much havoc and destroy so much in a short time as the Democrat Party has done. I know it took them years to plan and execute this dastardly plot, and now that they have power, they will do everything possible to strip America of anything not nailed down and tune it to their relentless advantage. The looting began in the streets and continues to the halls of our government. Anyone familiar with the commentaries of our good friend Charles Dickens knows that he frequently references the fall of the Roman Empire. It is said that Rome ruled the world for over 1,000 years, but the empire officially endured 503 years. And there are 8 primary reasons for Rome's demise. Invasions, economic troubles, over-reliance on slave labor, the rise of the Eastern Empire, overexpansion and military spending, government corruption, political instability, the arrival of the Huns, the migration of the barbarian tribes. Oh, let's not forget Christianity and the loss of traditional values. And finally, the weakening of the Roman legions. Does any of this sound even remotely familiar? Can you see the parallels in our lives, in our country? Rome lasted for over 1,000 years. We've abbreviated this cycle to 245. This because we Americans are so damned efficient. Let's talk a little bit about the parallels of Rome's failure. Invasions. America was once a place of refuge for millions of defranchised people needing a home. They became American. They assimilated. Now we're inundated with people that insist on retaining their origins and changing America into the shithole they just left. Secondly, economic troubles. Our national debt is $29 trillion, climbing every minute. $29 trillion. Think about this for just a moment. My app is outdated. Who cares? Later. Get out of my face. I have to do a quick calculation here. God, my phone's just too loaded with junk today. Hold on. What is this, 2021? Oh, good Lord. 26 years. National debt is $29 trillion, and 26 years ago, we were climbing at the, we're chomping at the bit. Because the Clinton administration had increased our national debt to $5 trillion. Our tax revenue today is $4 trillion. Now, I know math is a weak point in education, but it's pretty damn simple. We're $25 trillion short. And if these massive spending bills materialize, we're going to reach nearly $40 trillion, and we keep writing checks on an empty account. Any questions? Now, what all about this rise of the Eastern Empire business? Middle East, China, been a thorn in everyone's side since the beginning of time. And bungles gave Iraqistan $85 billion in high-tech weapons, 5,000 highly motivated ISIS and Taliban fighters, a fully operational air base, and now is brokering deals for the oil we could produce ourselves. He gave China trade deals and most of our manufacturing, allowing them to choke us into submission. We've got an overexpansion in military spending. The fiscal year 2021 budget is $753.5 billion. America's 15 million people in our military in 80 countries with 750 bases. And why? We're not imperialists nor colonialists. Are we an empire or just the world's uncompensated police force? Big thanks to NATO and the UN for playing along. What in the living hell are we in 80 frickin' countries for? What a joke. We deal daily with government corruption, political instability. And this alone would take more pages than you'd care to read or more hours of broadcasting than you'd care to listen to. Let's just ask if San Francisco really needs a $200 million Pelosi Park. Or if $174 billion for electric vehicle charging stations across America makes sense for only 0.003% of the registered cars in this nation. Oh, let's not forget the Wuhan virus fiasco and the tissue of lies used to crater the economy and confuse and control us, but to add billions of dollars in revenue to a few lucky big pharma companies. Remember the part in Rome where we talked about the arrival of the Huns, the migration of the barbarian tribes? Oh, God. All we got to do is look to our open southern border and appreciate the parallel. Because this also plays into point two about slave labor and economic troubles. The onslaught of tacitly invited but undocumented cheap labor and their reliance on welfare and other social support systems is going to further decimate our proposed $253 billion, leaving their maintenance and care and feeding and health care, education and subsistence on the states where they're dumped. What about Christianity, the loss of traditional values? Because it's been replaced by newer, insidious religions like the Green Movement or inclusion, diversity, wokeism, critical race therapy or theory, white supremacy, Antifa, BLM, the LGBTQIA, CS, MFers. There's no end to the list of ideologies diluting our traditional values, people. The needle on our moral compass is spinning, searching for a center that few people acknowledge or even miss because our lives are full of attractive distractions leading us astray from a traditional moral base. We are merely sheeple searching for a shepherd ready to follow any feel-good doctrines and charlatans with a sob story. Gee, did he mean the word sob or did he mean S-O-B? And finally, back in history, the weakening of the Roman legions. Sensitive, self-aware, self-actualized, CRT-ready volunteers now stand where actual soldiers once stood. Well, it's not to say they're not well-trained or dedicated to our country, but their leadership is more concerned with racial awareness, overcoming white supremacy, than building or leading a fighting force. Oh, I admire anyone who takes his oath of office, as many of us did. However, we question the political leanings of those in charge. These are America's fighting forces and should not be aligned with any political party. You know, Karl Marx once wrote that history repeats itself. First is tragedy, second is farce. That was witty, but far from true. History is never repeated, but it borrows and steals and echoes and commandeers the past to create a hybrid, something unique out of the ingredients of past and present. This quote points directly to our current situation, my friends, that the power brokers, the cabal, they know their history. They use its lesson to wrest, extort what they want. America. Right now, we are merely ripe plums ready for picking. Yeah, go back, reconsider the list of 8 Roman failings as a reference. They played this chase match brilliantly. But there's not much left for us to moderate or conservative citizens. We'll be the minions for the Demosoc party. They know just how to handle us. They've been doing it for decades. You can't win every skirmish. You got to lose a few to win the war. It's like the game of chess, where you sacrifice pieces to gain an advantage. No, this war has been strategic all along, and the Demosocs are close to victory. Let's make this real short and simple. The parallels to Rome's fall are painfully obvious. America's about to follow, and short of a miracle, there's little we can do to stop it. There are many who pray, awaiting the midterm elections as potential salvation, but don't think for 1 minute that the Demosocs are going to give up one congressional seat without a protracted battle. Oh, they hone their election rigging skills in the 2020 presidential contest and now stand ready to engage. They've proven that they are masters of manipulation and subterfuge. Look at who occupies the seat of American power. We have the most influential, ineffective puppet on the planet. Bungles the clown is our president, and his laughable clown policy is a cabinet. He found himself in the end zone, actually thinks he scored a touchdown. And he's clueless. And that's precisely what the Cabal wants. Oh, and just in case you're wondering, the Cabal is the Demosoc party. They have the money, the tools, the power to do whatever they damn well please, and they want this country. And by the way, my friends, they're very close to having it. It's sickening, is it not? What's the tie? Many things. If you're interested in reading later the piece that we did earlier about how governments seize control of money, because sometimes listening to it, you can't absolve it all. You can't absorb it all. So go to metropolis.cafe. It is the top entry. Charles Dickens' latest piece, which I've radically retitled. Charles originally entitled it 12 Months. I added that Rome wasn't destroyed in a day. And then made reference to 30 pieces of silver, but that's kind of an inside thing with Charles and I. 12 months. That's nearly how long we've had Joey screwing it all up. Or is 12 months the estimation as to how much longer we're going to survive? Could be either one. Your best to call. Rome was not destroyed in a day, currently published on Federal Observer. Share these things. Read them carefully. Because the sacking of Rome is beginning to resemble exactly what we're seeing in America today. It ain't a good thing, folks. It's not a good thing at all. Now, today's Thursday. Tomorrow is, well, I think it's Friday. We are going to continue with part two of our Ella Fitzgerald program, doing the music of Cole Porter. That'll be tomorrow night. I got some things in mind for the following Friday night, but we'll see what happens. I have a project tonight to get back to work on my closet, get this thing put together, reinstalled, and get my clothing back in it, and get these closets emptied out. I moved a lot of stuff back into my bedroom today, things that I've got to get out of other people's areas and spaces. I'll have a shelf up later tonight. It's going to be loaded, Jack, loaded. I want to get that stuff done. And so we're going to work on it. What are we going to close out of here with today, buddy? Probably should close out with, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, because that fills the time. Do we have the time? I don't know. I want to thank you for being with us. Obviously, tonight's program was kind of a mixed bag, but there was intertwining with the Roman story, and we're facing it, people. Take care of yourselves. See you. Do you think we have time? These are the days of the open hand. We will not be the last. Look around now. These are the days of the beggars and the choosers. This is the year of the hungry man, whose place is in the past. Hand in hand with the ignorance and legitimate excuses, the rich declare themselves poor
and most of us are not sure if we have it too much, but we're taking our chances, say. I sang 20 years and a day, but nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flame. It's hard to love, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to hope when there is no hope to speak out. Dead skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time. To what she can. And charity, charity is the coat you wear twice a year. This is the year of the guilty man. Your television takes a stand, and you find that what was over there is over here. So you scream from behind your door, say what's mine is mine and not yours. I may have too much, but I'll take my chances, say. I sang it 20 years and a day, there's nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flames. It's hard to love, Jesus has so much to hate. Hanging on to woe, there is no hope to speak out. In the wounded skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time.
Sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at TLBTalk.com and join the social media revolution.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.